It's not often that an artist lets others in on their creative process, but Jocelyn Jackson is exceptional. For 2 years, she has taken us through her reflections on writing a novel in City Light segment Writer to Reader. That novel, The Almost Sisters, was published last month, and Jocelyn Jackson joins us now in studio. Jocelyn, welcome back to City Lights.
Oh, thank you. It's so nice to be back.
Well, first, I must tell you how thoroughly I enjoyed this book. It is wonderfully written, and there are stories within stories that made me think you are the South's answer to Scheherazade.
Oh, well, thank you. That's a lovely compliment.
And you hopefully won't be telling stories just to save your life.
Sometimes that's what I think most novelists feels like doing.
How did overhearing a conversation at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport help you create this story?
Oh my goodness. That was actually a different novel. It's true that I am an inveterate eavesdropper. I like to, but I'm a very specific kind of eavesdropper. Like if you're seated near me at a restaurant, go ahead, don't worry. I'm probably not listening to you. Because if I listened to your whole meal's conversation, I would get so much context. I like just the little things you hear in a snippet that sort of make you go, what is the context for that? Who are these people and what made him say that to her here in the airport in public? And so sort of doing these invented histories when you hear people say such strange things. I remember a young couple in the airport, and they had obviously been traveling. They were very tired. And she turned to him just so frustrated, and she said, no, you're not hearing me. I want to eat something delicious. And I just thought, like, what is he offering her? And what does that say about their young marriage if she's asking for something delicious and he's like, well, I know there's a Chili's on Concourse C. So just those little snippets can sometimes lead to a whole book.
And here I thought that is where the Almost Sisters began, with something very Southern, that you wanted something deliciously Southern. Anyway, I listened back to all of our Writer to Reader, so forgive me for conflating one. But the main character in this story, Leia, is a graphic artist and creator of a popular comic book series, Violence and Violet.
Yes.
Describe Leia's situation as the book begins.
Well, you know, she's nerd famous, which is not the same thing as real famous. In her real life, she has this stepsister who's sort of goop and perfect husband, perfect house in East Beach in Virginia. And she's kind of nerdy, never married. But when she goes to these comic book conventions, she is a rock star. It's sort of like how novelists feel at Decatur Book Fest. Most of the time we're schlumping around Trader Joe's, but at Decatur Book Fest we're rock stars. And she is kind of feeling herself, and she gets into the tequila, which was never the handmaiden of good decisions. And she meets a very attractive African-American man in a Batman suit, and that kind of works for her, and eventually she grabs him by the utility belt and takes him up to her hotel room. And you know, she's a very level-headed person. Usually it's a little bit out of character for her, but when she gets home, that really should be the end of it, except that Batman has given her something more than a night to remember. She is pregnant.
A little bat person,
a baby bat.
So she winds up pregnant by Batman, which is all she can remember, because
yes,
she never asked Batman his real name.
Yes.
or saw him outside of his costume. Jocelyn, are you personally interested in that world of comics, superheroes, and those surreal gatherings at conventions, or was this research?
I married well. I have a husband who keeps his comic books in sleeves, and my brother is nerd famous. He is a sculptor. You know all the little gaming miniatures that people use, the little orcs and fairies and monsters and Medusas? My brother is the guy who sculpts the originals for those. And he's nerd famous. He's one of the three miniature sculptors who first had their names put on their work because people would look for his stuff specifically.
Albeit very tiny.
Very tiny.
Font, but if you look closely. So this helps me understand at one point in the book how you describe a Christmas tree that is entirely decorated in a Star Wars motif. In fact, the whole scene, everything in the room surrounding the Christmas tree is out of Star Wars. I wondered how you came up with that.
Well, my dear friends, the Garbers, are slightly nerdy, and they did a Star Wars Christmas tree one year. And I was like, I'm stealing that and putting it right in my book. And they were like, with our blessings.
I love it. Let's move along in the plot line. Leah has a sister, Rachel, whom
yes.
you mentioned, and though Leah was named after the princess in Star Wars, there is a parallel you make to the biblical story of Leah and Rachel. Would you talk about the inspiration you drew from the book of Genesis?
Sure. The whole book, actually, the idea of the book was origin stories. Genesis is, of course, it means our origin story. Then superheroes all have an origin story, like where they came from. You'll also notice there's a lot of nods to Faulkner's A Rose for Emily in this book. Those are my literary origins. I lean into Southern Gothic tradition. And then I look at my own family history, which my origins are my ancestors were a slaveholding family, a family of slaves, and a family of very destitute white sharecroppers, which is sort of the whole spectrum of the South that comes together in this one small town. So all of those things, the way I came at the book was to come from four different ways of originating to make one story.
And origin story was the original title
you had chosen. And I mean, thematically, this is a book about how history is alive in the present. So, and I think Genesis is alive, and I think superheroes are, I wish we had some more of them True North Wonder Woman kind of superheroes
really?
Alive in the present. And my own family history I see playing out in the South.
There's beautiful writing about pregnancy. I found myself 30 some years later just wishing I were pregnant again, reading your descriptions of the joy of little Digby, as she calls him, growing inside of her.
You are alone in this. I have a needlepoint in my house that says better 40 than pregnant. but yeah, it was a lot of, I mean, it was sort of a celebration. I was pregnant twice in my life, and I drew on that a lot. And it's weird, like in a literary way, in the new book I'm writing now, the narrator has a 9-month-old.
Oh.
So it's like I've gone through a pregnancy with this book, and now I'm remembering all those baby days. But yeah, I write about motherhood a lot. So
sweet.
And that pre-motherhood time is kind of primally magic and terrible and amazing all at the same time.
All at once. Leah didn't plan for her pregnancy to occur as it did, obviously. She said she wanted to fall in love, marry a dork like me, and make more dorks. How does this pregnancy change Leah's life?
Well, for the better. She says at one point, she's like, you know, I wanted a family. I didn't just blow every chance to make a family. I ran from it. And this is like a little piece of family has crash landed in my uterus. You know, this is a gift is the way she approaches this pregnancy. It's complicated because she is the scion of a very, very old Southern family, the Birches of Birchville, Alabama, and the child will be mixed race. So she, Leah is a progressive person and lives in a kind of a cool, funky, artsy neighborhood in Norfolk, Virginia. So that's
kind of like Decatur.
A little bit like the Decatur of Norfolk. And she, so But to go back to Alabama and prep her family for this and to want them to be as joyful as she feels is a thing that she has to look at and deal with.
If you've just tuned in, this is City Lights on 90.1 WABE. We'll be back with New York Times bestselling author Jocelyn Jackson after this short break.
Support for WABE comes from Maggie Kulik & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial. Information can be found at AmeriprisedAdvisors.com by searching Decatur, Georgia. Ameriprise. Be brilliant.
Tonight at 7 on PBA 30, join scientists and citizens alike as they observe the first total solar eclipse to traverse the U.S. mainland in more than a generation. Discover the storied history of eclipse science and follow current cutting-edge research into the solar corona. Watch NOVA, Eclipse Over America, tonight at 7 on PBA 30.
We're back with author Jocelyn Jackson. Her new book, The Almost Sisters, is her 12th published novel. Jocelyn has taken us through her writing process on City Light segment Writer to Reader. So it turns out that the protagonist, Leia's pregnancy, was unplanned, but she's very excited about it. And before Leia can break the news, which includes the fact that the baby is biracial, to her conventional Southern family, her sister Rachel's marriage has collapsed, and Rachel is in her full force, histrionic, self-centered mode. Worse yet, Leia learns that her beloved 90-year-old grandmother, Birchie, is showing some rather bizarre behavior for a proper Southern lady. Turns out she has been hiding her advanced dementia with the help of Waddy, who is her best friend since girlhood. And this is where the story becomes intricate. Before you tell us about Leia's grandmother, Jocelyn, would you please read some passages?
I would love to.
Page 21 and then page 68.
Oh, I apologize for this. It is not quite lunchtime, and y'all are all going to be hungry after this. You've chosen some food reading.
Very evocative.
For me, summer began with the taste of catfish rolled in cornmeal and coarse salt, served up crisp and smoking hot on paper plates with sweet tea and Dixie cups, iceberg and cherry tomato salad drenched in homemade ranch dressing, cheese grits, fried okra, huge wedges of icebox pie for after. That meal was still the very taste of freedom to me. And then later, she's getting ready to go down to dinner at Birchie's house. The smell of roasting hens, peppery and succulent, wafted up the stairs as I got dressed, like a sensory argument for respite. Birchie would serve them with fat slices of the summer's first heirloom tomatoes from the back garden and her famous cornbread. To make it, she saved bacon drippings in a coffee can by the stove, and she'd put some of that grease into the cast iron skillet and set it in the oven. She'd make batter while the rendered fat got so hot that it was close to smoking. The sizzle of the batter landing in that pan was the kitchen soundtrack of my youth.
I love the kitchen soundtrack.
Thank
description.
You. Yeah.
So her summer spent with her grandmother, Birchie.
Yes.
Were the happiest moments of Leia's life.
Oh, yes. She loves Birchie. And I just have to say, because it's funny to me, I've eaten that cornbread.
Did Birchie bake it for you?
No. Kevin Gillespie made it for me at Revival in Decatur. I ate that cornbread while I was writing this book. We went to dinner there, and I went home and had to, I mean, it was worth writing about. But Birchie is, I mean, food and love and all that kind of stuff. And she and Waddy are 90 and 89, and they to me are the heart of this book.
And yes, their relationship is so beautiful. And we come to see that, like, Leia and Rachel, They are almost sisters.
Yes, there's a bunch of pairs of almost sisters in the
Yes.
book.
Would you describe the relationship of Birchie and Lottie?
Well, they're cradle friends. Birchie's mother died in childhood, and Lottie's mother was her wet nurse. And so Birchie and Lottie had spent all their days together from babyhood on, and they are very, very bonded. They both married. They both had their families. The friendship withstood that. And now, at this age, they're all getting pressure from their children and grandchildren to move into assisted living. And so they've sort of moved in together as this bastion against, you know, these young people trying to tell them how to live their lives. Nobody tells them how to live their lives. And they are both like the matriarch of their separate churches. Birchie is white and Lottie is black. And Lottie goes to Redemption and Birchie goes First Baptist. But they are, like, Lottie was the beloved pastor's wife for many years. So she's done, you know, everybody whose marriage was in trouble went to Lottie. She's taught Sunday school for 1,000 years. And Birchie's the same way. So these are people who are the female leaders of their community, the venerable grandmothers of their community.
But still separate communities.
Absolutely.
Within one small Alabama town.
Which is true. I mean, if you go to a small Alabama town, there's a black Baptist church and a white Baptist church. There's a black Methodist church and a white Methodist church. It's one of the things I think is the most troubling about Christianity right now. And I mean, I say that as a Christian. It's I get to be critical of the church because I'm in it and of it. So it's one of the things that I think is deeply wrong with Christianity.
Mm. In another of your writer to reader segments, Jocelyn, you discussed why being proud of a book means including the uncomfortable. How, as a white person of Southern heritage,
Yes, it's so comfortable to talk about race.
How did you navigate telling a story that lays bare the horrors of racism?
Well, I mean, part of it is I tried to stay in my lane, right? I mean, I don't know that I have any business trying to write about the black experience of being Southern. Like, if you want to read that, go read Queen Sugar. That is a fantastic book. And one I loved, but that I don't think I could have written. And I do write outside my experience. You have to, but because my experience is one life and it's very narrow. And I think novel writing is nothing if not the practice of empathy. Like, it is the deliberate practice of empathy. So you do have to step outside of your comfort zone. But I also think that when I'm approaching talking about race in the South, I do think I need to stay in my lane. You know, I'm writing about the experience of a woman who realizes that her son's life is not going to look like her life. And I think Leia's smart. I think she's progressive. I think she's incredibly likable. But I don't think that she's ever been put in a position where she had to practice that level of empathy when she thinks about her son and how the South is going to be a different place for him. It changes it from when you just think about it intellectually.
Yeah. Would you talk further about what you describe in the book as the Second South? Leah says, I always thought my homeland was a single place. I was wrong.
Yeah. I mean, there is a South. There is a small town South, which is where I grew up and a place I dearly love. Leah describes it as it's all sweet tea and decency and Jesus. And she says, and it's a real, true place. That place exists. I've lived in it. I've been in it. But it's like that drawing of a rabbit that's also a duck, where if you look at it, you might see a rabbit for years and then it shifts and you see a duck. Underneath that, there's another South. And maybe if you're white and if you are educated and if you have money, you never even see it. And so it's easy to say, that's not there. That's not true. Or even if you're just, you know, comfortable working, blue collar person living in the small town South, and you think we're all nice people here, we're not racist. That's not true. But if you step outside of your comfort zone a little and look around, it's there. I know it's there. I've been there. My I have family members who live in it. So it's sort of, yes, I think two Souths exist at once. And as long as we live in that first South that's just decency and sweet tea and Jesus and deny the existence of the second one, which is black, bloody history and oppression, that the ramifications are still just tearing through our society today in ways we see out play out on the news every night, as long as we do that, we're allowing systemic racism to continue. We're not doing anything overtly racist, but we're absolutely allowing systemic racism to continue.
Author Jocelyn Jackson talking about her new novel, The Almost Sisters. We'll be back in a moment on WABE. This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. We're back with author Jocelyn Jackson. Her new book, The Almost Sisters, will be featured prominently at this weekend's Decatur Book Festival. We were talking about the Second South, the uncomfortable area you forced yourself to enter when writing this book because you thought that ultimately would make it a better book and makes you a better writer. Into this South, both tainted and hopeful, little Digby will be born. I imagine him emerging from the womb in a little Batman costume, by the way.
That sounds terribly uncomfortable, but all right.
How do you imagine his future as a biracial child in 2017?
I think it's going to be pretty good. I hope that's not naive, but I do think one of the ways we solve our problems is generationally. I look at, I have kind of extraordinary parents who reinvented themselves. I have some relatives who are deeply racist. And when I was little, my parents told these people in no uncertain terms, here are words you will not say and ideas you will not espouse in front of our children, or you won't see our children. So we were very shielded from that Second South growing up. And my dad was Army, so we moved around and we experienced a lot of different cultures growing up, and that was really good for us, I think. And this is sort of, these are small town Southern people who kind of reinvented themselves because they wanted us to be better, and we are better. And then I look at my children, I look at where I am and the kind of stuff I struggle with, and I look at my children and they're better. And I also think, I think Leia comes to a really smart conclusion. I'm not going to spoil the book, but at a certain point in the book, you can't change the world. You can't go, I'm going to step out and solve racism or economic problems or anything like that. You can't do it. What you can do is look around and say, here is my life and here are the lives that my life touches. How can I build community here that's going to be life-giving and connective and inclusive? And so I think with a mom who's thinking in those terms, in micro terms, and with the dearness of Wadi's family to her family, I think he's going to have a really good support system. I think he's going to have a really good community.
In just the 3 minutes, 4 minutes we have left, I'd like for you to touch upon another very important aspect of the book, which is that it deals with aging and familial love.
Yes. Well,
that must have been difficult to write about.
Yeah, you know, death is that thing that's always there. It's always coming. And I don't even know how we'd live. We just don't think about it from day to day. But it's this, and it's the end. I mean, I look at my parents. They are elderly. They are getting on up there. We're struggling with some things with them. And my mom and dad will look at me and they will say, honey, you want us to go to assisted living and you want this and that, but we're in a part of our life that is still ours. And honey, all the parts are good. And so even though Birchie and Wadi are approaching the very end of their lives, I wanted to show them as having these whole, full, rich, embedded lives. And even with all those struggles, I believe that. I believe all the parts are good. Even the hard parts are good.
Well, I must say that Birchie's display of dementia early on.
It's not subtle.
It's hilarious. I mean, that's how I was able to say, oh my goodness, this is marvelous, instead of poor thing first. I mean, would you just talk a little about what happens at that church supper?
Oh my. I think that would involve words I can't say on radio. It's a rowdy scene, we'll say that. I get a lot of letters about it. Let me encourage you to read the book just for that scene, if nothing else. And I'm going to be talking about that at Decatur Book Fest a little bit. I can be a little bit rowdy there.
Yes, because the FCC is not there for you to contend with. But colorful does not begin to capture this very elegant Southern lady's disclosure about some goings on within the church community.
Yes, at a single church fish fry, she wrecks two key church marriages and makes people have a hard time probably looking at the choir room without blushing.
On top of which, and this you can talk about, I thought it was your nod to contemporary cuisine. This is a church fish fry,
yes.
But it's 2017.
And they have replaced the fried catfish with salmon in, as the pastor calls it, papalote. You know, steamed fish with vegetables, at which Birchie feels like they're on the high road to apostasy. You cannot take away the hush puppies and like that iceberg lettuce salad and the ice and replace it with steamed fish and some asparagus. And that for her is the breaking point. She says, that will not do.
Blasphemy has been committed in this church. Where are those bacon drippings for the cornbread that I make?
When an elderly Southern woman tells you that will not do, it's time to like bar the door and get under the sofa.
Well, Jocelyn, you have given us such special insight into the conception, the gestation, and birth of the Almost Sisters. Thank you so much for taking us through your creative process, and congratulations on the outcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's a special book to me for that reason. Like, to explore my own process that way here, I think it made me more aware going through the book, and it was a really neat thing for me too. Thank you.
Well, I should mention that you can hear the conception, reflections, and gestation of the Almost Sisters if you visit our website, wabe.org, and search Writer to Reader. Jocelyn is a marvelous narrator and, in fact, is also an actor, and she's going to give a presentation on audiophiles, lend us your ears. We should mention that the main discussion of the Almost Sisters will be in the Decatur Book Festival Saturday at 12:30 in the Sanctuary of Decatur Presbyterian. Later in the day, I hope you get to take lunch at 4:15 p.m. in the historic DeKalb Courthouse. Jocelyn will be part of that. Audiophiles, lend us your ears. We'll have links on our website, wabe.org/ City Lights. Thank you again.
Thanks, Lois.